Okay, welcome to part six of The Law and the Law. We'll look tonight at the case of Bakke versus University of California Board of Regents and the Torah's perspective on affirmative action, a perspective. Sponsored as always by Becky Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas, Yonah Ben Rabbi Elay. So we've already seen in a number of cases how vexing the issue of race has been in America. We saw how bad the problem was, and now we get a glimpse of how bad the solutions can sometimes be as well. So Bakke was not the first case in which the Supreme Court addressed the issue of affirmative action, but in fact it was the first case where they dealt with it substantively. We'll get back to another case a little later on. Affirmative action is a term that itself is highly charged and substantive. That's why it was selected. All these marketing tools are carefully selected. Affirmative action sounds virtuous and upbeat and positive. Its counterpart, reverse discrimination, is also highly charged, and it dashes the ice water of reality on people's good intentions. There's another term that was as equally upbeat as affirmative action, but it's opposite, and that's what's known as equal opportunity. And those became the two sides, the affirmative action side versus the equal opportunity side. And the terms really frame the debate. If there's one thing that America has endeavored to do, it's to eliminate discrimination based on artificial characteristics. So being black cannot be a handicap to equal treatment, but should being black, or for that matter being a woman, or being an Aleut, or being an American Indian, or being part one of some other favored group, entitle one to special treatment. What then is the difference between special preferential treatment and unfair discrimination? So if we cannot favor whites in public accommodations because of their skin color, so what sense does it then make to favor blacks because of their skin color? And you get, of course, into the bizarre minutiae of the whole affirmative action apparatus today for the last 30 years. Who was black? Is President Obama, for example, a black for these purposes? Well, yes, even though his mother was white, and his mother's ancestors were slave owners, and his father, of course, was African, so he's not part of the American black experience. So what's the logic? How could he benefit from affirmative action in order to undo the legacy of slavery when he and his ancestors are only involved in slavery as owners, not as slaves? But yet he possesses 50%, don't even need that much, but 50% of black skin color in order to qualify under the statutes. Now, Bakke had to, not the statutes, on the court decisions, Bakke had to somehow finesse the question. Is discrimination inherently evil, or does it matter who is being discriminated against? Is it any more or less moral to deprive whites of rights than it was to deprive blacks of rights? These are all very sensitive questions. Martin Luther King himself had eloquently wished, August 28, 1963, Michael was there probably, in front of Lincoln Memorial, for liberty and justice, for freedom and equality for all blacks. What did he have? A dream. I quote, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." So that dream, shortly after he was assassinated, was largely abandoned by the black establishment and by liberal statesmen in order to create politics of group identity, which was new. It dated from Roosevelt's time, was discussed, but nonetheless, it was new in this context. No longer in America would the individual have rights as an individual, but rather individuals would accrue rights insofar as they were members of a preferred group, or not so, if they were not members of the preferred group. Alan Bakke ran smack into that reality. Now, Bakke's situation and its purported resolution was, again, as we've seen a few times already, so convoluted and so baffling that it generated more questions and more litigation and many more cases as well, all revolving around one central question. Does equal really mean equal? What happened? Here's the case. Alan Bakke was born in Minnesota in 1940. He was the son of a postman. He graduated the University of Minnesota with a 3.46 GPA and a degree in engineering. He paid for college through the ROTC, and after college he joined the Marines. He served for 4 years, including a stint in Vietnam. Upon discharge, he went to work for NASA in California, and then in 1972, he first applied to a number of medical schools. He was rejected from all the schools. He applied late that year, but he wrote a letter of complaint to his first choice, the school nearest his home, University of California at Davis, near Sacramento, to complain about their quota system. In 1973, he applied again, and he was rejected again. Unfortunately, his interviewer this time was the same person to whom he had written the letter of complaint the year before. Bad draw. So he didn't go very far. Now, Cal Davis was a relatively new medical school, and in 1968, it inaugurated its, what they called its special applicants program, setting aside 16 seats out of 100 for what they called economically and or educationally disadvantaged applicants and members of a minority group, blacks, Chicanos, Asians, American Indians. Agavurcha, why would a medical school want to take in people who are educationally disadvantaged? It doesn't seem the best qualification for a physician, but I leave you to be the judge of that. All these applicants were placed in a separate pool. In other words, you apply to be a special applicant, you're not in the regular pool of applicants. For example, other applicants with a GPA below 2.5 were automatically rejected. Not so the special applicants. Now, ordinarily, applicants would be rated based on the interviewer's summaries, overall grade point average, especially science courses grade point average, his MCAT scores, letters of recommendation, extracurricular activities, the interview, other biographical data, all of which resulted in a total, what they call benchmark score. That score was then weighed against all other applicants, resulting in admissions or rejections or waiting lists. Bakke didn't make a waiting list either time. Special applicants had different standards completely. I quote from the decision. During a four-year period, 63 minority students were admitted to Davis under the special program and 44 under the general program. No disadvantaged whites were admitted under the special program, though many applied, meaning under their own regulation, whites could have applied on grounds they were economically disadvantaged, poor whites, or some are educationally disadvantaged. No white was accepted on that basis. Bakke scored in his second application, and his benchmark score, 549 out of 600. The decision dryly notes, in both years, special applicants were admitted with significantly lower scores than respondents. Bakke's MCATs were all in the mid-90th percentile. The special applicants averaged 46, 24, 35 in the regular categories with a GPA of 2.88. After his second rejection in 1973, Bakke sued on 14th Amendment grounds that the state had violated the Equal Protection Clause, and also as a violation of Section 601 of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which provided, inter alia, I quote, that no person shall on the ground of race or color be excluded from participation in any program receiving federal financial assistance. Of course, Cal Davis fits into that category. Bakke was excluded because of his race and color, or at least he was treated differently because of his race and color, therefore he was turned down. So it seems pretty straightforward. Bakke sued. The trial court held that the Cal Davis admissions policy violated the Equal Protection Clause, that it was unconstitutional, and that it could not take race into account in its admissions process. So, King's dream was alive, but not for long. Both sides appealed because the trial court also ruled that Bakke had failed to prove that he would have been admitted even if the special program did not exist, because there's an element of subjectivity in it. So it turns out that both Bakke and Cal Davis, or University of California Board of Regents, they both appealed to the Supreme Court. Bakke to be admitted on grounds that he was rejected on because of discrimination, and Cal Davis because they wanted their admissions policy upheld and the trial court ruling reversed. Well, the case came before the Supreme Court in 1978, really 6 years after Bakke applied to medical school. They made a decision that defied logic and provoked much controversy and really left the area unsettled. It was a 5-4 decision, but a very, very unique and bewildering 5-4 decision, because the 5-4 majority was cobbled together with two different groups, two different sets of four, joined Justice Lewis Powell in this decision, deciding different aspects of the case. So there was a 5-4 majority for two parts of the decision, but only a plurality on one key part, meaning that it received the most votes of any opinion, but not a majority of the court. Not the best way to make policy. The gist of the 5-4 decision written by Justice Powell was that Cal Davis was wrong not to admit Bakke, and in fact Bakke was ordered admitted to Cal Davis, and that the special applicants program was unconstitutional. That was one 5-4 majority. But in a separate 5-4 majority, the court also ruled that in the future, Cal Davis, and by extension other schools, could take race into account as a factor in their regular admissions process. Essentially, what Cal Davis attempted to do through its special admissions process, the court, in the guise of fairness and constitutionality, now mainstreamed and made it part of the regular admissions process. So it was a personal victory for Bakke. You know, it was 5 years after he filed suit. The case was decided June 1978, as I was getting ready to enter law school myself, but it was a setback for law and order and for constitutional coherence and ultimately for race relations. Let's look at the two parts of the decision. One part permitted Bakke to enter school. The other part also permitted Cal Davis to use race as a factor. And again, those were different and narrow majorities. So Bakke's admission was supported by Powell, and then what we'll call the conservative four, Berger, who was Chief Justice at the time, Berger, Potter, Stewart, William Rehnquist, and John Paul Stevens. But the latter four supported only the decision to admit Bakke. They disagreed with Powell's reasoning. So in fact, they joined his decision only to permit Bakke's admission. But they did not like his reasoning, and they all filed separate concurrences on that part of it. The part that permitted Cal Davis to use race as a factor was supported by Powell, and then by the liberal four, Brennan, White, Marshall, and Blackmun, but almost all of them for different reasons than Powell articulated. I think in all there may be a dozen different opinions. Almost everybody had something to say on it, and nobody really agreed on any type of coherent philosophy. So it really was a philosophical mess. Now, the language of Title VI seems clear. No person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Now, listen to how Powell massaged this. Powell held that words like discrimination can be subject to different interpretations given the time and place. And although one might think that it was meant to render the law colorblind, as the dissenting force said here, in fact, he said, the Civil Rights Act was enacted against the backdrop of discrimination against blacks. So therefore, that was the focus of the Civil Rights Act, and discrimination could therefore take place only in the context of discrimination against blacks as a group or as an individual. Now you see why the four, the conservative four, did not subscribe to that, even though they followed Powell's decision in admitting Bakke. So Powell said, as such, Congress, in enacting the legislation, never considered that it would be used against preferential treatment for these same minorities who were heretofore persecuted. The purpose was equal treatment for Negro citizens. The bill never contemplated the effects of unequal treatment for whites. Those are the words of Powell. So therefore, the courts always go to the legislative history, when they want to, of a particular act or law, In this case, they said the Civil Rights Act was not meant to help anyone but blacks or other groups, but certainly not whites. So Title VI was not grounds for reversal. But the Equal Protection Clause was explicit. It's the 14th Amendment. No state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of its laws. There doesn't say anything about discrimination or race. It just says equal protection of the laws. That means everyone. Still, Cal Davis had argued that white males, such as Bakke, are not a discrete and insular minority requiring extraordinary protection. The court responded to that by citing Korematsu, you remember our very first case this year. All legal restrictions which curtail the civil rights of a single racial group are immediately suspect. That is not to say that all such restrictions aren't constitutional. It is to say that the courts must subject them to the most rigid scrutiny. So here, in effect, the legal rights of whites are being curtailed simply because of their skin color, something that the court elsewhere had termed, I quote, odious to a free people whose institutions are founded upon the doctrine of equality. And even if the Equal Protection Clause was premised on the equality for blacks, nonetheless, Powell continued, as the nation filled with the stock of many lands, the reach of the clause was gradually extended to all ethnic groups seeking protection from official discrimination. Cal Davis, in effect, had asked the court to turn back the clock and enshrine in law benign discrimination against whites. This Powell and his conservative cohorts refused to do. He said there are no special wards entitled to a degree of protection greater than that accorded others. In other words, there are really three problems with the special admissions program at Cal Davis. First, preferences are not always benign, and individuals, real, living, breathing people, citizens, are harmed to assist the group, and that is offensive. Secondly, Powell wrote, preferences reinforce common stereotypes holding that certain groups are unable to achieve success without special protection based on a factor having no relationship to individual worth, a point that has hampered all affirmative action programs since. People assume, and people do assume, that any minority is not there on merit, even if he or she is. One reason why affirmative action is anathema to black conservatives. There's a third reason as well, third problem, special admissions program, and Powell said, there is a measure of inequity in forcing innocent persons, in respondent Bakke's position, to bear the burdens of redressing grievances not of their making. That is to say, why should Bakke suffer and have his career dreams thwarted to allow an unknown black to take his place? Bakke bears no personal responsibility for the harm historically suffered by blacks in America. Well, the school had also claimed another goal was to improve health services in underserved communities by educating members of those communities, but there's no evidence that that in fact would or did occur, because there was no obligation for black doctors who graduated to head for the inner cities or rural areas. Additionally, the state has no right to prefer or reject someone merely because of race or ethnic origin, even to ensure a certain percentage of a particular group within the student body. There, the key phrase became merely because. How did the court then turn around and permit the use of race as a factor in admissions with Powell and the liberal four? So the court ruled, very, very clever, I don't want to say devious, it sounds pejorative, all right, very devious, the court ruled that the attainment of a diverse student body is clearly a constitutionally permissible goal for an institution of higher education, and academic freedom is included in the First Amendment, freedom of speech. So what Powell held with the liberal four was that schools could use race as a plus factor in admissions because the school has the right to freedom of speech. That's academic freedom. Very interesting twist.
what is prohibited under the 14th Amendment now becomes permitted as freedom of speech under the First Amendment. The school's freedom to choose the student body it wishes based on considerations unique to it. I guess you could mention speech, but I guess you could add to freedom of association as well. No wonder Powell could only muster a plurality to support this, because if a school wanted to limit the number of blacks in order to maintain diversity, say in its classrooms or on its football team or basketball team, that school will be invaded by the feds in a New York minute. Nonetheless, Powell wrote, "Ethnic diversity, however, is only one element in a range of factors the university properly may consider in attaining the goal of a heterogeneous student body. Although a university must have wide discretion in making the sensitive judgments as to who should be admitted, constitutional limitations protecting individual rights may not be disregarded." Does that sound contradictory? Yes, it is. It's really attempting to have it both ways. And especially professional school, not college. College, you make a better argument. But professional school, the need for the perspectives of different races and ethnicities is not as plausible as it might be in a college setting. But at the end of the day, based on this new and approved formula, some white person, some Jewish person, these days some Asian, will be denied admission to the school of his choice simply because of his skin color. You just can't say you're doing it on that basis, and what the school cannot do is have an arbitrary number of seats set aside for minorities, to wit, a quota, like Cal Davis had, that operates based on special criteria. I quote again, "So race or ethnic background may be deemed a plus in a particular applicant's file, yet it does not insulate the individual from comparison with all other candidates for the available seats." The problem is, of course, if you don't maintain a certain percentage, then you're sued also. So there's pressure on every admissions committee to maintain certain percentages. Applicants who lose out because of a deficiency in his combined qualifications, and not simply because of his race. So Bakke was admitted because Cal Davis could not prove that he would not have been admitted had there not been a special admissions program. It's a very interesting, almost fascinating approach that they took, trying to get Bakke in because they realized he'd been wronged, and recognizing how quotas really are anathema to the American spirit, and yet trying to maintain some preferential treatment for minorities, because it's also part of the American historical legacy. But what's the difference between race as a so-called plus factor and race as the determinant? It's very hard to say. The liberal four, the ones I mentioned, they supported what Cal Davis had done. They supported quotas as well. They supported the notion of affirmative action as remediating past discrimination. And Title VI, they said, and they all wrote, you know, Brennan and Marshall and Blackmun, the Title VI did not mean the Constitution was colorblind and that racial classifications are not per se invalid under the 14th Amendment. And more, they said, "Unlike discrimination against racial minorities, the use of racial preferences for remedial purposes does not inflict a pervasive injury upon individual whites in the sense that wherever they go or whatever they do, there's a significant likelihood that they will be treated as second-class citizens because of their color." In other words, because whites enjoy so much privilege in society, therefore they won't be that disadvantaged if they are rejected from a particular school. So that minority of four supported affirmative action and quotas, and they approved the Cal Davis program, but they lacked the fifth vote. It was John Paul Stevens, ironically enough, as we'll see, who wrote the dissent of the conservative four, which joined Powell in admitting Bakke and rejecting the quota system. Stevens wrote the dissent from the notion of race even as a plus factor. He was joined by Berger, Rehnquist, Potter, Stewart. Pretty simple. The dissents are almost much briefer than the decision. Bakke was denied admission because of his race. End of discussion. The plain language of the statute favors Bakke. There's not much more to say. I quote from the dissent. "The denial to innocent persons of equal rights and opportunities may outrage those so deprived. and therefore may be perceived as invidious. These individuals are likely to find little comfort in the notion that the deprivation they're asked to endure is merely the price of membership in the dominant majority, and that its imposition is inspired by the supposedly benign purpose of aiding others. One should not lightly dismiss the inherent unfairness of and the perception of mistreatment that accompanies a system of allocating benefits and privileges on the basis of skin color and ethnic origin. And then, very cheekily, they quoted Hubert Humphrey during the debate on the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and 65. What was Humphrey looking for? He's one of the major sponsors and moving force in the Civil Rights Act. Humphrey said, "The answer to this question, what's meant by discrimination, is that if race is not a factor, we do not have to worry about discrimination because of race. The Internal Revenue Code," again, this is Humphrey speaking, "the Internal Revenue Code does not provide that colored people do not have to pay taxes, or that they can pay their taxes 6 months later than everyone else. If we started to treat Americans as Americans, not as fat ones, thin ones, short ones, tall ones, brown ones, green ones, yellow ones, or white ones, but as Americans, if we did that, we would not need to worry about discrimination." That's what the conservative four quoted in dissent. In essence, the Constitution should be colorblind. That was the legacy of the Civil War. Well, what happened? Bakke entered Cal Davis that fall. He kept a very low profile. He never gave interviews. He wanted to blend in. He graduated. He did his residency at the Mayo Clinic, moved back to California, rather. He retired, by the way, just I think 2 years ago, I read. His name was in the news a decade ago. Again, you can't make these conclusions so recklessly, but this was the news story. Bakke surfaced when one of the minorities that had taken his place in 1973, who replaced him at medical school, one Patrick Chavis, was murdered in Los Angeles. Dr. Chavis had his medical license revoked in 1997 because of gross negligence in the treatment of three liposuction patients, one of whom died. What makes it very interesting is that in the 80s, Chavis was extolled by Ted Kennedy and others as a poster child for affirmative action, as the type of person that should get preferential treatment in order to increase minority participation in the professions. But the bottom line is he wasn't working in the inner cities. He was doing what he wanted to do, and you know, practicing his craft and earning his money until he fouled up and people died and he had his license revoked and then he was murdered in Los Angeles. But affirmative action lived on. In 1996, the Fifth Circuit Court in Texas ruled in Hopwood versus Texas School of Law, truly the same case as Bakke, except Hopwood was a white female. There, the court, it's Texas after all, they say using race as a factor in admissions was unconstitutional. Well, that would seem to negate what Powell had written 18 years before. But the Supremes refused to hear this appeal, the appeal of that case. And so for a time, from 96 on, you had a circuit court essentially in disagreement with the Supreme Court. But again, the Supreme Court decision was so convoluted in any event that it was subjected to differing interpretations. The language in each of the school's admission policies were really to determine each time. But they did revisit this in Grutter versus Bollinger in 2002. There they entertained this matter again. Barbara Grutter was a woman. Lee Bollinger was the dean of the University of Michigan Law School. Now he's the president of Columbia. And again, in a 5-4 split decision, it's always 5-4, the court ruled the Constitution, I quote, "does not prohibit the law school's narrowly tailored use of race in admissions decisions to further a compelling interest in obtaining the educational benefits that flow from a diverse student body." That is to say, they could not have a quota, but they could have a number that would achieve the critical mass of diversity that the school sought. What's the difference between a quota and a number that achieves a critical mass? Only an abstract physicist would have to figure that one out. Now, this opinion was written by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and she wrote, very interestingly, that 25 years from now, that's 2027, affirmative action will likely be unnecessary to achieve racial balance. So she put a time limit on it. Her opinion was joined by Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, the two Jews on the court, who wrote in a separate opinion that they do not share the view with Justice O'Connor that affirmative action will be unnecessary in 25 years. They see it as le'olam v'ed ad bias mashiach sekenu. David Souter also signed, and surprisingly, Justice Stevens, who had dissented in Bakke, he joined the majority opinion now in Grutter versus Bollinger. Of course, we know that Stevens had turned very sharply to the left in the ensuing years. He was an appointment of President Ford. It's fascinating that had Stevens not changed his mind from what he had written in 1978 in dissent, he would have joined with Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy to eradicate affirmative action once and for all. What do you think he wrote explaining why he shifted from his position in Bakke to his position in Grutter versus Bollinger? Not one word. He did not say anything decision to account for the fact that he just changed his mind. Clarence Thomas wrote in dissent that if something will be illegal in 25 years, as Justice O'Connor presents, then it should be illegal today as well. That's how law operates. And he also, again cheekily, quoted Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, some 140 years earlier. And as you know, Thomas has always been against affirmative action. He said, this is Frederick Douglass, "In regard to the colored people, there's always more that is benevolent, I perceive, than just manifested towards us. What I ask for the Negro is not benevolence, not pity, not sympathy, but simply justice. The American people have always been anxious to know what they shall do with us. I have but one answer from the beginning. Do nothing with us." Exclamation point, Thomas put in. "Your doing with us has already played the mischief with us. Do nothing with us. If apples will not remain on the tree of their own strength, if they are worm-eaten at the core, if they are early ripe and disposed to fall, let them fall. If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall also." Frederick Douglass, "All I ask is, give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Leave him alone. Your interference is doing him positive injury." Now, in fact, this is borne out by very recent studies. Recent, I mean the last few months. The graduate rate of blacks in college and graduate school is far less than those of whites. Blacks who enter college wanting to major in science, technology, engineering, or math are 36% as likely as whites to get their BAs and 15% likely to earn a PhD. Blacks drop out of law school at twice the rate of whites. This comes from a study at UCLA and from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. So affirmative action has a well-meaning cruelty to it. Blacks are admitted to institutions where they're more likely to fail. And just in the last few weeks, I read this, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, this state of affairs was criticized by the historically black colleges like Howard and Grambling and Morgan State and others that have seen the quality of their applicants fall because, so to speak, the better black students are hopped up. They're enticed by the elite schools who want their diversity numbers to meet that critical mass. Worse, though, they get students that are not as highly rated. Worse, though, has been its effect on the individual minority who's stigmatized as one who has received special treatment even when he has it, what President Bush called in a different context the soft bigotry of low expectations. It's hard to overcome that, to overcome the fact that the equality issue still provokes. I remember reading, I was but a child at the time, but in the late 1960s, to protest quotas that existed in New York and teachers and elsewhere, Rabbi Meir Kahana, Hashem Kom Damo, threatened to demonstrate outside of Shea Stadium because the Mets had only one Jewish player, Art Shamsky. And Rabbi Kahana maintained, based on New York's Jewish population, the Mets should have had six players. Why not? So what does the Torah have to say about all this? Well, as we've discussed previously, race is not the relevant factor to any distinctions between people according to the Torah. Everyone's created its Emel Elohim in God's image. So to Jews, skin color is as meaningful as hair color or eye color. And one of the obligations of the Jewish government, and here I'm quoting again from Naftali Bar Ilan, Medina B'Yisrael Kli HaTorah, the obligation of the Jewish government is to ensure that there's no distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between the rich and the poor, man and woman, scholar, ignoramus, the supporter of the government, the opposition to the government, the Jew and the non-Jew. There has to be equality in the apportionment of national assets and taxation and obligations and rights and freedoms and opportunities. Yet there are obviously inequalities in every system, as no one can be treated exactly the same. People are different. A Soloveitchik once said that Korach was a heretic when he said, that the whole congregation is holy and God's in the midst. The Rav said it's simply not true, that different levels of holiness even among Jews. So can society promulgate different rights for different sectors of its population? Different privileges, different advantages. Well, Israel, you know, as if it didn't have enough on its plate, is now debating legislation in the Knesset. But I mean now, like this week and last week, that gives preference for civil service jobs to those people who have served in the IDF. Now, clearly the legislation is targeting Haredim and Arabs. Not for long, though. Part of the dynamic in Israel today, Haredi enlistment to the IDF has increased sevenfold in the last few years. I think that's part of what's behind the backlash of trying to force soldiers to listen to female singers, but to force them. Because the more Haredim that serve, the less the argument of draft dodging can be used as a cudgel against them. Is such legislation just? Can you say that in a society, does a person who serves in the army, or a Shirut Lumi, or does some type of national service, can society make those distinctions? Well, certainly a society has the right to reward those who serve it in some favored capacity and handicap those who don't. I don't think it's inherently immoral. But the difference is that the yardstick here is one that's accessible to all, because everyone can enter the army or do Shirut Lumi or even some other form of national service. It's not a disqualifier like race that automatically eliminates certain people from participation. Now, the Torah itself supports inequality in one very familiar mitzvah, matnos aniyim, giving gifts to the poor. The poor are singled out for special treatment, zdaka, leka, chikcha, peya, meiser, ani, etc. And the rich have to give them. It's not a kindness. They're obligated. Basin can seize it from them if they don't give. So it's a special mitzvah to help them. Rambam says, Hilchos Matnos Aniyim Perek Yud, the highest form of tzedakah is Hamachazik B'Yad Yisrael Shamach, a person who strengthens the hand of a Jew that has been brought low, to help him find a job, get him a loan, a partnership, or something of the sort. Now, I've always thought that the big mistake of American affirmative action is that it does not assist the poor, but rather the black or the Hispanic, etc., all based on ethnicity. It's absurd, and the absurdity of this is apparent not only in education, but also in business. In many states, and especially the federal government, mandate that a certain percentage of job set asides for minorities. You must do business with them or you will be prosecuted. So people have made, or you'll lose the government contract. So people made a nice living as race hucksters hustling money from corporations on this basis. So this produces this anomaly. The children of Jesse Jackson, who's a millionaire, were awarded lucrative beer distributorships in Missouri instead of giving a hand to poor whites who don't need that assistance. That is to say, the absurdity of affirmative action today in education is that a poor white teenager from Appalachia, who's the son of coal miners, is handicapped in admissions because he might lose out to the black son of a Harvard Law School graduate who's very wealthy. If affirmative action was geared to the poor, period, poor whites, poor blacks, poor Hispanics, etc., I think it would win broader acceptance across the society. And the Torah would support such a thing as well. And also wind up assisting blacks in the U.S. who are still disproportionately poor. Of course, you might say there's a problem with that as well. The Torah says, Lo sakir panim ba mishpat, you can't recognize faces That is to say, in judgment, we can't show favoritism to one party or another. We treat the poor litigant like we treat the wealthy litigant. The rich and poor are judged by the same legal standard. Each are accorded the same rights in court. But there's clearly still a difference, not in law, but in society's treatment, that gives the poor a needed boost in order to create social harmony, but mostly because it's the right thing to do. So where are Jews in this? Jews were caught in a pickle when Bakke was first adjudicated, but really before that. That was the first affirmative action case. It's the case of De Funès versus Odegaard. Marcus De Funès, Jr., of all things, was a Sephardic Jew. He was rejected from the University of Washington Law School, and right away, you have to be a lawyer, right away he sued. And in fact, he sued, he won in trial court. And the trial court ordered him admitted, and he was admitted, he was in law school. By the time the case reached the Supremes in 1974, they ruled 5-4 that the case was moot. Moot because it was no longer applicable to anybody. He was almost finishing law school, and therefore they didn't have to adjudicate it, what's known in legal parlance in Latin as kicking the can down the road for someone else to deal with. That's what they did. Now, most Jewish organizations supported De Funès, which angered the black establishment and shattered what was called, up till then, the historic black-Jewish alliance. Now, the reason this was clear, historically Jews suffered from quotas going back to Europe. The numerus clausus laws, the closed number of Jews that could be admitted to various institutions of higher education in Europe, then in America, until the 1950s, that severely limited the number of Jews who could be admitted to university and medical school, law school, etc. From the 19-teens to the 1930s, when it was widely practiced, Jewish enrollment in Columbia, my alma mater for example, fell from 35% to 15%. Blacks were completely excluded. In Europe it caused some Jews to convert, but also saved many Jewish lives, numerus clausus, because many of those Jews simply left those countries for the free world. It's part of the lore of my wife's family. Her grandfather wanted to go to medical school, and he was closed out because he could not make it inside the quota. I never believed it, but that's the story. But the Jewish DNA, in any event, has an allergy to quotas for that purpose. And yet, it's also drawn, because of our own history, at the same time, to support blacks. Most liberal Jewish organizations supported Bakke in his quest, but by the time Bollinger came around, most of the liberal Jewish organizations had made their peace. They're still against quotas, but they made their peace with race as a plus factor. But only the ADL, among the left-wing Jewish groups, opposed the University of Michigan plan, and even they supported the use of race as a factor in admissions, as long as it was not afforded more weight than other factors. Meaning what happened in many schools, if you were being graded on, say, 20 factors, each was assigned a certain number as to how many points that factor was worth. Well, if race is worth, say, 8, and grades are worth 7, then of course, or even 8 for that matter, then many people will be behind the 8 ball. Jews still disproportionately suffer from affirmative action. Jews with better grades are bypassed for minorities with worse grades. That's the reality of our time. Using race as one factor is not unreasonable on its face, because one can argue it gives an advantage to someone through no personal achievement, true. But schools also credit the legacies. Those children of alumni or children of big donors, they also have a leg up that's unearned, as well as athletes, never really in college to learn altogether, and others as well. But at least there's a benefit, a material benefit that accrues to the university from those alumni, but to compensate the descendants of slaves and thereby penalize the non-descendants of slave owners makes little sense. Yeah, there's another form of inequality which we recognize, and that is treating Jews differently. Should a Jew give another Jew preferential treatment in business? Of course. Does it apply as well to education? Well, it's hard to justify a Jewish admissions officer to a secular school favoring Jews. That would be a breach of his fiduciary duties to the school. But in business, the Torah is quite clear. If you're buying something, if you're selling something to your friend, buying something from your friend, Rashi says, in bosa liknos, k'nei Yisrael chavercha. If you want to buy something, buy from the Jew, your friend. If you want to sell something, sell to your Jewish friend. That would be natural. Of course, I know many Jews in Dafka don't want to do business with Jews, but that's a different discussion. All things being equal, we should try to favor Jews. Is that discrimination? Yes. Is it permissible? Yes. Why? What's the difference? Here's the difference. Chazal tell us, it's family. We're family. Everybody recognizes, all Jews are family. Everybody recognizes that one is allowed to treat family differently. Even the courts have recognized that in their various decisions. In fact, the very purpose of family ties is to have a group of people that will look after you, even if you're unworthy and don't deserve it, and no one else cares about you, simply because of blood. And the Jewish people are one family. That itself underscores another common distinction in countries between the rights and privileges of citizens and those of non-citizens. So the American left is always a flutter to ensure, for example, that terrorists on the battlefield and held at Guantanamo or elsewhere receive all the constitutional rights of American citizens. So it makes no sense from a number of perspectives, but it's still a major source of contention today. The fact is that there's no difference between being a citizen and being a non-citizen, so why be a citizen? In the Torah state, non-citizens have rights, but not the same rights as the rights of citizens. The differences, though, will be in the margins and not in essential areas, and each difference requires some justification for it, and that really every country recognizes. The problematic area, and that takes us back to Baki, is distinguishing between citizens. How do you do that? Those distinctions have to be based on the Torah. We have distinctions. Kohanim, Levim, Yisraelim, men, women, an adult, a minor. We have those distinctions in Halacha, but they're rooted in something. Many of the distinctions are rooted in some compelling social need. Within the group, distinctions are rarely justifiable. Distinctions between groups can be, depending on what group you're part of. But it's defined groups, given afforded status by the Torah. But nonetheless, even there, it's very hard to justify. We operate a simple principle. Mishpat achad yelachem. As one law applies to everybody, that's the basic rule, and it has exceptions to it. And that's crucial. Affirmative action sends the terrible message that rights inhere in the group and not in the individual. Here, an individual benefits, not because he deserves to benefit, he wasn't victimized at all, but because he's part of a favored group, in some case only half part. In Judaism, obligations devolve upon someone, sometimes because he's part of a group, like a Kohen, and because he's an individual, obligations, but rights almost always flow to the individual because of who he or she is or does, and not because of some ancillary feature of their personality, and certainly not something as random and as trivial as race. So I found one attempt to posit a cogent justification for affirmative action under the Torah. It's an article written in Tradition, summer 1978, by Rabbi Abner Weiss. I think for years he was the rabbi at RJC, and then in California, then he went to England. He tries to compare it to the laws of Ha'anokah, severance, that's paid to the Eved Ivri, the Hebrew servant, when he leaves the master's employ. But of course, even he concedes that affirmative action affords rights to a group, whereas Ha'anokah applies to individual compensation. There's no defined sum. And Ha'anokah applies to the victim and is paid by the alleged victimizer or the master. Not to the victim's great-grandchildren, to be paid for by complete strangers unrelated to the original discrimination. So he then relies on, and it's a bit of a stretch, Kodem Mekom HaMunach, Darkei Shalom, the ways of peace, to help them out, Kiddush Hashem, think of how sanctified God's name, we support them. ultimately said, Horashah, society needs it now. Even he admits that all of these fail, and he concludes by saying that affirmative action is not the solution to the American problem because of the discrimination against the innocent, the bureaucratic chaos and confusion is subject to great corruption and definition. Who's a black? Some one grandfather's black, one great-grandfather, do you then qualify? And he ends the resentment of the rest of society, which has to be considered as well. Rambam says in the Mora, in part 3, Perek Nun Gimel, the Rambam defines chesed as kindness to those who have no claim upon us, and also kindness to those who are due kindness in greater measure than they're entitled to. That's chesed. Mishpat is pure justice, while tzedakah is righteousness. Tzedakah means giving everyone his due, esher magia lo, and showing kindness to every person according to what he deserves, kafi haro'i lo. Tzedakah is carried out not when we fulfill our obligations, but when we do something that is dictated by our moral conscience, mipnei malos hamidos. So our pursuit of virtue must not be flawed by the infliction of harm on someone else. And ultimately that's where Baki fails the test of Torah. Today it's bolstered, of course, by a tailwind of votes and influence, etc., politics, but it's long past the day when it is recompensing blacks or Hispanics or Aleuts or Indians for past discrimination. At the end of the day, equal opportunity sounds more like the American dream than does affirmative action. It also suggests equal opportunity is a basic principle of Torah as well. I thank you all very much. Next week we'll look at, not a major case, but an interesting one, Goldman versus Weinberger, the rights of an Air Force officer to wear his yarmulke, and how the Supreme Court dealt with that issue. Thank you very much.